Hello, I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch, and it's time for our birthdays. Margaret Peggy Kelly of Johnston, happy birthday to you, Margaret. And Joyce Lenz of Des Moines, happy birthday to you, Joyce. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. John Pacenti, Catherine Lewin, and Maya Laura, writing for the Palm Beach Post. We're praying and we're not stopping. The Surfside disaster. Rescuers cling to hope of survivors in condo rubble. Officials refused to give up hope Monday that somewhere in the mountain of rubble that was Champlain Towers South, there is a survivor clinging to life. 5 days after the collapse, the death toll rose to 11 after first responders pulled remains from the site Monday, and 150 people remain unaccounted for. Governor Ron DeSantis vowed again to find the cause of the unprecedented collapse of the 1981 constructed 12-story condominium building, even as speculation from structural engineers fluctuated daily, if not hourly. Did the collapse start from the top down, as some analysts of surveillance videos suggest, or was it rooted in the garage where a consultant had found major structural damage? Was it a sinkhole or poor construction? The answers vary depending on the media outlet and the expert consulting. Miami-Dade Fire Chief Rai Jalalas made clear that any talk of moving from a search and rescue to a recovery mission was premature. There's a misunderstanding regarding that everyone believes that the search and rescue operation should cease after a specific time. That's far from the truth, Jadala said. He said that even when that grim moment comes, it's not going to be from television, it's not going to be from an individual down the street. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava struck a similar tone. We're going to continue to work ceaselessly to exhaust every possible option in our search. I repeat, the search and rescue operation continues. Rafael Polk, an EMT, a member of the United Hatzalah Israel Psychotrauma Unit, arrived Sunday with other members of his 8-person team to assist family members emotionally and mentally as they wait to hear about their missing loved ones. Polk said families of the missing are in an elevated, elongated state of unknowing and on the edge of despair. His team sat with the families to map out where people were in the building at the time of the collapse to help rescuers with identification. At the same time, families are coming up to us and saying, my brother was in here, my sister was in this apartment, my family was in this apartment. On Monday morning, Representative Carlos Jimenez, a former firefighter, said people need to give rescuers time. Miracles do happen every once in a while, so you don't want to call something off too early and then find out later that somebody was there alive and you could have gotten to them, the Florida Republican said. Jimenez added that obviously somebody could stay alive this long and was staying in search and rescue mode was the right thing to do. Champlain Towers South collapsed in the early hours of Thursday morning. I'm expecting miracles. I'm looking forward to that. We're praying every day, every minute, and we're not stopping, Surfside Mayor Charles Burkett said. We don't have a resource problem at all. We only have a luck problem, and we need to start getting lucky. Burkett said 240 rescue personnel were at the site and more were on the way. Burkett said more help is coming for grieving families. It's terrible. It's awful. It's like a missing airplane. They don't know where their loved ones are, he said. Besides emphasizing that the search is not over, officials hammered home the resources they are providing to survivors and said the investigation into what caused the collapse has begun. DeSantis said he spoke with representatives of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who will be investigating the disaster. The agency was created after 9/11 and has investigated disasters such as the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri in 2011 and Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico in 2017. They have never done just a straight building collapse that wasn't involved with either hazards or acts of terrorism, DeSantis said. This is going to be something that is important, and it's something that's going to be very thorough, and it is going to take a long time. That is the kind of horizon they work on. DeSantis said more immediate investigations by Miami-Dade County and the town of Surfside could shed more light more quickly, and suggested state regulatory changes were possible, if necessary, after those assessments. If there are things that need to be done at the state level, we obviously would want to get information as soon as possible, DeSantis said. Florida Agriculture Commissioner and 2022 gubernatorial candidate Nikki Fried said the state should consider new guidelines to oversee association boards. After we get through the search and rescue aspect, start digging through that, because, of course, we want to make sure that what happened here doesn't happen again, Fried said. There needs to be a new perimeters in place to oversee the association boards. Quite honestly, what is happening is when you have a board that potentially is a more senior, retired, and has a huge assessment, well, whose responsibility is that then? Among those missing were many South Americans and members of Surfside's Jewish community. JetBlue said Sunday that one of its flight attendants was among the missing. A doctor, teacher, and yoga instructor were also unaccounted for. Another team, Chesed Cell M's, arrived to assist teams with requirements that are necessary for an Orthodox Jewish burial. The nature of the disaster has made that crucial preparation difficult. Every part of the person should be buried and ideally buried together, so that makes it very difficult in a disaster scene like this one, Polk said. Perquet on Monday described an interaction he had with a child awaiting news of one of her parents who were in the building at the time of the collapse. The mayor said he had seen the 11 or 12-year-old girl at the site before with one of her parents, but came across her again Sunday night by herself. What she was telling me, she was reading a Jewish prayer to herself sitting at the site by where one of her parents presumably is, and that really brought it home to me. She wasn't crying, she was just lost, he said. Courtney Subramanian, writing for the USA Today, pressure mounts on policing reforms. Will overhaul get lost in Biden's anti-crime push? President Joe Biden's push to combat a rise in violent crime is stirring concerns among activists over whether it could sap momentum for police reform after a year of protests over the police killing of George Floyd and other Black Americans. Biden was elected amid a nationwide reckoning over race and policing, an issue he vowed to tackle on the campaign trail. The political reality has been harsher for the president, who's tried to strike a balance on passing big-ticket items such as coronavirus pandemic relief and infrastructure, while promoting work on campaign pledges on overhauling policing and gun control. A sweeping police bill stalled on Capitol Hill, where negotiations stretched beyond Biden's deadline to pass it by the anniversary of Floyd's death in May. Udi Ofer, director of the Justice Division for the American Civil Liberties Union, said that although crime prevention and criminal justice reform are interlocked, patience is growing thin among advocates. We have not seen President Biden put in the same kind of aggressive push on police accountability as he just did on crime prevention, Ofer said. It's time for him to put the same sort of weight of the White House behind police accountability. You're going to be hearing a lot more about the need for Biden to act. At the White House last week, Biden outlined a plan to crack down on gun trafficking and help beleaguered police departments hire more officers, a signal that the administration is taking steps to address rising national anxiety over an increase in homicides before the summer, when violent crime is typically more pronounced. This is not the time to turn our backs on law enforcement, he declared. The homicide rate is more than 30 U.S. cities, increased by 24% during the first 3 months of this year, compared with the same period last year, according to the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice. Gun-related deaths are up by 21%, according to the report, but violent crime overall is lower than it was 5 or 10 years ago. The White House dismissed Republican efforts to pin the crime wave on Biden, emphasizing that the increase in gun violence started 5 years ago and accelerated over the past 18 months amid the coronavirus pandemic. Although some cities reported spikes in other forms of violence, Biden pointed to guns as the most serious threat. The administration pointed to $350 billion in direct aid from Biden's COVID-19 relief plan, which cities and states can use to hire more police officers, and for alternative crime prevention initiatives such as summer jobs for at-risk teens and community violence intervention programs, a package the White House noted no Republican voted for. Biden issued a raft of executive orders aimed at curbing gun violence, including tightening restrictions on ghost guns, untraceable weapons that can be constructed from parts purchased online, and redirecting federal funding to community programs. Senate Republicans blocked sweeping gun safety legislation. The president's record on crime prevention comes with some political baggage. The Democrat wrote a major bill in 1994 that critics say is responsible for over-incarceration of young black men. Biden's involvement in the bill drew criticism from his opponents during the 2020 election. The president expressed regret over some aspects but defended others, including protections against domestic violence and funding for community policing. Defund the police. The crime spike has revived a GOP attack on Democrats over the defund the police slogan before next year's midterm elections, when Republicans look to seize control of the House and the Senate. A Democratic review of the 2020 election cycle found that Republicans successfully used the slogan to brand candidates as radical socialists, which contributed to Democratic losses down the ballot. Matt Bennett, co-founder of the center-left think tank Third Way, which helped compile the report, said last week's New York mayoral race could offer a roadmap for how moderate Democrats can navigate the message of police reform and public safety. Democratic mayoral candidate Eric Adams, a former police captain who holds a commanding lead, campaigned on public safety and denounced liberal slogans such as defund the police while promising to rein in police misconduct and abusive policing. Overwhelming data shows that voters of color don't want to defund the police for the most part. They are the ones who count on the police because in many of their communities, crime is a serious problem, he said. Defund the police attacks didn't just hurt with white voters, they hurt with black and Latino voters who didn't want their member of Congress supporting that kind of thing. A Suffolk University USA Today poll focused on Milwaukee residents' attitudes toward police underscores the challenge that Democrats face. 57% of residents say they oppose the phrase defund the police, including 44% of black Milwaukee residents versus 35% who say they support the term. A majority of the 500 adults polled say they do support redistributing taxpayer dollars from law enforcement to other agencies. When asked about cutting some funding from police budgets and using those resources for social services, such as for the homeless or mentally ill, 55% favor that idea. Ben LaBolt, a Democratic strategist close to the White House, said although there are differences in the party over the definition of defund the police, there's unanimity over police accountability. The North Star is not just what the Democratic Party supports. It's what does the average American support. It's what the persuadable voter supports, he said, pointing to the popularity of police reform. George Floyd Act. Biden has been unequivocal when he does not support dismantling police departments and has instead thrown his weight behind passing the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, introduced in Congress months after Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin was arrested for kneeling on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, even after Floyd lost consciousness. The bill was reintroduced in February, passed in the House in March, and faces a divided Senate. The Floyd Act would limit qualified immunity, a legal provision that shields officers from being held personally liable for unconstitutional actions on the job, and lower criminal intent standards. The act would establish a national registry on police misconduct, among other provisions. Negotiations over the bill, spearheaded by Senators Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, and Representative Karen Bass, a Democrat from California, have dragged on and left some activists frustrated that the president hasn't taken a more public role. The lawmakers said last week that they reached a preliminary bipartisan agreement, but details of the plan and a timeline were not immediately clear. Ofer said the ACLU said the bill shouldn't affect the broader discussion about crime prevention, as it's primarily legislation focused on police accountability. He said Biden could show his commitment to criminal justice reform by taking a stand on qualified immunity, a sticking point in the Floyd bill, and using the power of clemency to commute the sentences of people who are unfairly incarcerated. We're now expecting to see the same sort of passion, the same sort of commitment, and the same sort of audaciousness on our criminal justice reform and police accountability, he said of Biden and his anti-crime push. Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat from Maryland, said the White House has been pushing all sides involved to finalize an agreement on the bill. These two initiatives go hand in hand. There's a clear understanding that we need to move forward on conversations on Capitol Hill, but also that we need to confront gun violence, he said. His strategy takes a unified, comprehensive approach. It's a good fit. Some activists are willing to give the administration time to see if it can fulfill a promise to usher in more police oversight and accountability of individual officers while confronting a national concern over crime. Mark Morial, CEO and president of the National Urban League and a former mayor of New Orleans, said some activists would like the president to be louder. In this moment, I'm going to trust the president's judgment, Morial said. I'm going to trust them, but the truth will be whether we get a stronger bill. And my position on whether the president should be more active and more vocal could change depending on those circumstances. Jonathan Hettinger, writing for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, Seresto collars under EPA review. It could take a decade for ruling on pet product. The Environmental Protection Agency launched a review into the best-selling Seresto flea and tick collar this spring after injuries and deaths linked to the product spurred a congressional inquiry, class action lawsuits, and a formal complaint. The collars, which release small amounts of pesticide onto the fur of cats and dogs for months at a time, were the subject of 75,000 EPA incident reports, including at least 1,698 pet deaths since their introduction to the market 9 years ago. Any determination by the EPA about the product's safety is likely to take years. Since 2006, the EPA has received three public petitions asking it to ban pesticides in pet products over concerns about human health risks. One of them, filed this year, involves Seresto. The other two took an average of 10 years for the EPA to resolve, even as some of the products it ultimately deemed dangerous remained on the shelves. More than a decade ago, the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council petitioned the EPA to ban the use of a pesticide called tetrachlorovinphos in pet products such as flea and tick collars. The organization cited studies showing that the chemical, a possible carcinogen, had been linked to brain and nerve damage in children. What followed was 12 years of delayed action, lawsuits, bureaucratic red tape, and a new EPA assessment of the pesticide that confirmed some of the nonprofit group's concerns about its use in pet collars. Despite that, tetrachlorovinphos has been called, and also called TCVP, is still used in some tick and flea collars. The long battle over TCVP shows how hard it can be to remove a chemical from pet products, even when governmental scientists, experts, and federal appeals judges say it's harmful to children. In sum, the EPA's years-long delay on this critical matter of public health has been nothing short of egregious. Ronald Gould, a Ninth Circuit Court appeals judge, wrote in April of 2020 in a decision mandating a response by the EPA to the Natural Resources Defense Council. For more than a decade, Gould wrote, the EPA has frustrated NRDC's ability to seek judicial review by withholding final agency action, all the while endangering the well-being of millions of children and ignoring its core mission of protecting human health and the environment. The EPA canceled some uses of TCVP in pet products, but allowed others to be sold. EPA spokesman Kenneth Labe said in an email that the agency found pet products containing TCVP, including the popular Hartz UltraGuard collar, met registration requirements under federal pesticide laws. In other words, he said the risk level is acceptable. In an emailed statement, Hartz said its flea and tick collars present no risk to humans or pets when used as directed. Also, defending its products was Elanco, which sells the Seresto flea and tick collars. The nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity petitioned the EPA in April to ban Seresto collars because of the risks associated with its two pesticides, imidacloprid and flumethrin. Seresto collars are the subject of more than 75,000 reported incidences of pet harm and nearly 1,000 incidences of human harm in the past 9 years. Elanco's statement said the majority of the incidences involve minor skin irritation at the site of the collar. The company said it investigated each report of pet death and found no link to the collars. Elanco said its collars are safe and the overall incident rate was 0.3%, meaning 1 in 300 pets had a reported issue. There's no medical or scientific basis to discontinue their use, the company said. The EPA's pesticide office generally assumes a chemical is safe until it is proven otherwise, rather than taking a precautionary approach, said Philip Landegren, a pediatrician, epidemiologist, and founding director of the Global Health Initiative at Boston College. This is a systemic problem within EPA, and I hope the new administration confronts it, Landegren said. In my mind, as a pediatrician, there's every reason to think tetrachlorovinphos on dog collars is dangerous to children. From nerve gas to pet collars, TCVP belongs to a family of chemicals called organophosphates, which were used as nerve agents during World War II. Among the most well-known is sarin gas. After the war, U.S. companies marketed the compounds as insecticides. They became the most widely used class of such products. TCVP was first registered in the USA in 1966 and approved for killing and preventing insects on crops, as well as on livestock and pets in the form of powders, liquids, and collars. 5 years after TCVP was registered for use, Hartz bragged in a television commercial that it had sold more than 20 million flea and tick collars containing the chemical. It would take all the dogs and cats registered in New York City, Los Angeles, Tampa, Boston, San Diego, Puerto Rico, Chicago, and then some to wear all the Hartz 90-day collars we've sold so far, the ad said. It wasn't until 1993 when a groundbreaking study from the National Academy of Sciences showed how pesticides harm children that the EPA cracked down on organophosphates. That study, led by Landegren, prompted the passage of the Food Quality Protection Act in 1996 and the ban a few years later of nearly all organophosphates from in-home use. One exception to the EPA's ban on indoor organophosphates, TCVP. There are two main ways a pesticide can be banned. The EPA can cancel its registration after determining an unreasonable risk to human health or the environment, or the company that's registered to use the pesticide can voluntarily relinquish it. A court can ban a pesticide, as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals did with dicamba in June of 2020, after finding the EPA underestimated and ignored the risks it posed. That kind of court action is infrequent. Under federal law, anyone can petition the EPA to ban a pesticide, and the agency must respond. The National Resources Defense Council asked the EPA in 2009 to cancel the use of TCVP in pet products. As part of its petition, it cited an EPA-funded study in 2008 that found evidence of TCVP in the urine of children who played with pets wearing the flea and tick collars. It also cited its own study in 2009, which found that after 3 days of wearing a collar, at least half of the pets had enough TCVP residue on their fur to cause brain damage to children. The EPA waited more than 5 years to respond and did so only after the council sued for an answer. From 2004 to 2015, the EPA received 40 petitions to revoke, cancel, or suspend pesticides used for a variety of reasons. 9 of those petitions resulted in unreasonable delay lawsuits because of the agency's lack of policies and procedures to manage public pesticide petitions in a transparent and efficient manner, according to an Office of Inspector General report in 2015. The Natural Resources Defense Council was behind 7 of those lawsuits, including a complaint in February of 2014 to the D.C. Circuit Court, asking it to force a response by the EPA on a petition to ban TCVP. During that 5-year delay, Hartz sold millions of its flea and tick collars. 7 months after getting sued, the EPA responded to the petition. It was denied. The agency said its risk assessment found the levels of TCVP in the products to be below the threshold of concern, a glaring error in assessment. The EPA categorized the pesticide in the collars as a liquid formulation instead of a dust solid formulation, which is more potent and harmful to human health. TCVP collars contain both. Hart's UltraGuard flea and tick collar labels says as the collar begins to work, a fine white powder will appear on the surface. That prompted a lawsuit in January of 2015 arguing that the EPA unlawfully denied the petition based on inaccurate science. The EPA agreed and promised to conduct a new risk assessment. More than 7 years after the original petition was filed, in December of 2016, the EPA released that assessment. It found that children are exposed to TCVP at such high levels in the collars that they are at risk of delayed mental development, lower IQ scores, and increased chances of autism and attention disorders in children. The agency, which was under the last days of President Barack Obama's administration, pledged to take action within 90 days. Instead, under President Donald Trump's new administration, the EPA sent a letter to the National Resources Defense Council in March of 2017 that said it would make a decision between July and September while conducting a wide-ranging assessment of TCVP. September 2017 came and went. So did all of 2018. In May of 2019, a decade after the first petition was submitted, the council asked the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to force the EPA to respond. It took nearly a year for the court to act, and when it did in April of 2020, a three-judge panel scolded the agency. Repeatedly, the EPA has kicked the can down the road and betrayed its prior assurances of timely action, even as it has acknowledged that the pesticide poses widespread serious risks to the neurodevelopment health of children, the opinion said. The court ordered the EPA to respond within 90 days. On the 90th day, in July, the EPA issued an assessment that the risk from most collars to humans were acceptable. The EPA reached an agreement with Hartz that one of the seven collar types would be canceled and the rest would undergo minor changes to the design and labels that describe how to use the collars. In September, the Natural Resources Defense Council again challenged the approval of TCVP. In an executive order on his first day in office, President Joe Biden pledged to revamp the EPA to limit exposure to dangerous chemicals and pesticides. While EPA acknowledges that it took longer than anticipated to respond to the NRDC's cancellation petition, the agency's petition denial was informed by more precise data than had ever before been available to evaluate the risk of TCVP pet collar products, the agency wrote in a court filing. The council said the lack of a significant change is disappointing. There was an opportunity for the Biden administration to shift course here and put children's health first, and we're not seeing that yet, said Miriam Rotkin Elman, a senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. This story is a collaboration between USA Today and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, an independent nonprofit newsroom covering agribusiness, big ag, and related issues. USA Today funds a fellowship at the Center for expanded coverage of agribusiness and its impact on communities. A photograph accompanying this article has a caption that reads, TCVP belongs to a family of chemicals called organophosphates, which were used as nerve agents during World War II. Among the most well-known is sarin gas. After the war, U.S. companies marketed the compounds as insecticides, and it shows a fence with a warning sign on it. It says, warning, pesticide, insecticide, spraying in progress. And the last picture has a caption that reads, Atiana Vargas of Los Angeles claims in a federal lawsuit that her 10-year-old Siberian Husky named Lolita developed a cancerous lump on the neck after wearing a Seresto flea and tick collar. It's a montage of four pictures of the Siberian Husky Lolita, and one shows her with her owner. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Our first year-turn guest columnist is Peter Fisher. He writes, boost the workers who let people work. President Joe Biden's American Families Plan would commit to major new investments in child care while boosting the economy and paying for itself. It would add hundreds of thousands of new child care and preschool jobs, raise the compensation of the child care workforce to at least $15 an hour, and ensure working families do not need to pay more than 7% of their income for child care. These are benefits to millions of families and millions of young children, improving the quality of child care and enabling those in the field to make it a career. These investments also benefit business and the economy by enabling more people to work and boosting the purchasing power of people who work in child care. The plan would be financed by eliminating a variety of tax preferences for those with incomes over $400,000. The child care investments in the bill, amounting to $40 billion annually, would be largely offset by the increased revenue from two important reforms ending special tax treatment for capital gains incomes for the wealthiest in society. Taxing capital gains for individuals making over $1 million per year at the same rate as wage income. Taxing unrealized capital gains at death. The special treatment of capital gains means income from selling stock or real estate, for example, is currently taxed at a lower rate than income from wages and salaries, rewarding speculation over work. The second reform closes a huge loophole where some such income is never taxed at all, which happens when the wealthy leave an asset to heirs. Consider what happens with a stock purchase of $1 million that is now worth $10 million. The $9 million income gain already is taxed preferentially at a lower rate than salary income if the investor sells it. But if that were not enough special treatment, the tidy gain goes totally tax-free if the stock is passed to an heir. The business community and advocates for working families agree on the importance of increased federal investments in childcare, which have strong bipartisan support. Childcare workers are the workforce behind the workforce. The quality childcare produces long-term benefits to children and to the economy. The positive economic effect of the American Families Plan derives in large part from the impact of creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs, paying childcare workers better, and increasing their consumer spending, enabling more people with children to work, and increasing the productivity of the workforce that needs childcare services. The American Families Plan sets priorities on how to invest in a prosperous economy. With respect to childcare and capital gains preferences, its priority is investing in working families, including those providing childcare, and the benefits of doing so to local businesses, and not on continuing tax breaks for the wealthiest Iowans and Americans. The public needs to hold those in Congress accountable for the choices they make at this critical time. Peter Fisher is a research director of Common Good Iowa, a liberal nonpartisan public policy research and advocacy organization with offices in Des Moines and Iowa City. Fisher is professor emeritus in the School of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Iowa. And now in letters to the editor, our first letter comes from Kathy Wickert of Colfax. Palo Alto County unfairly holding up solar project. Dean Gunderson, chair of Palo Alto County Zoning Commission, presents a biased picture regarding the solar project under consideration in Palo Alto County in his June 27 essay. He writes as if there is no logic to the proposed placement of solar farms. There was little resistance by the commission when the prior wind project was approved along an extended ridge of land, and wind generators, power lines, and a transformer station were built to conduct electricity. Now that the energy company wants to expand into solar energy and make use of the infrastructure already in place, Gunderson wishes to pick and choose which landowners may have solar farms. There is little to fear regarding potential tile damage and its relation to the drainage system, as expressed by Gunderson. Solar companies and landowners have vested interest in maintaining those tile lines so land remains undamaged for current and future use. In fact, the environmental effects will be positive in that fertilizers and other chemicals will not be draining into groundwater in nearby Five Island Lake. As for worries about tax revenue, as long as the sun shines, electricity will be produced. It is time for the Zoning Commission to get on board with this expansion of clean energy and move the project along. From Marceline Johnson of Des Moines, GOP can't complain about hardball tactics. Mark Tyson's column of June 27th, titled "Obamacare Shows Big Government Won't Be Undone," is the most blatant example of chutzpah that I've seen in some time. He begins by castigating the Democrats for shunning bipartisanship while ignoring the fact that the sole agenda of the Republicans while in power was to stifle any Obama project put forth. Despite their hypocritical acts of manipulating the Supreme Court to fit their agenda, now they're crying because it has now ruled three times for the benefit of over 31 million people. And then the sentence about Democrats having no interest in reaching across the aisle? Hello? Several Republican members of Congress have made no secret of the fact that their main goal is to defeat any Biden proposal. Our Iowa legislature and representatives are playing by the same handbook. It sure is different when the other team won't play nice, isn't it? And finally, from Beryl Richards of Nashua, investigations of January 6th are a waste of time and effort. By a fairly casual check, I find there are at least three federal agencies involved in the search for and prosecution of the people who participated in the attack on Congress. I expect the number is much larger in reality. Why is the U.S. House insisting on hearings that cost tax dollars and for the most part waste time? We will learn nothing new, and the only thing that will come from these hearings will be political posturing, and of course Nancy Pelosi will already have a target in her sights. Is it still Donald Trump, or is there someone else she is angry with? A special to the USA Today op-ed piece is written by Jonathan Zimmerman. Let them speak. Don't cut off the mic, even if you disagree. You may have heard about the impromptu graduation speech the valedictorian Paxton Smith gave last month at her Dallas high school. Abandoning her pre-approved remarks on the influence of media, Smith delivered a scathing attack on the recently passed Texas heartbeat law to restrict abortion. The speech went viral, and the internet exploded with praise from prominent liberals, including Hillary Clinton, who hailed Smith's guts, and comedian Sarah Silverman, who called her brave. "Paxton, thank you for having the courage of your convictions," tweeted former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke. "May we all use our place in this democracy to fight for what we believe to be right and follow your example." But if Smith had gone off script to commend the new measure, which prohibits abortion when a fetal heartbeat is detected, would people like Clinton and O'Rourke be applauding her courage and outspokenness? I think not. And that speaks to a much bigger problem in our culture, which is on not-so-grand display every graduation season. Call it freedom for speech that I like. When a young person takes a stand for something we agree with, we stand up and cheer. But if it's not to our political taste, we condemn it as too political. And you really can't have free speech on those grounds. Earlier this month at a high school in New Jersey, officials cut off valedictorian Bryce Dersham's microphone when he started discussing his experiences as an LGBTQ student. Before approving his prepared address, officials had urged Dersham to remove all references to sexuality and mental health issues on the grounds that such topics were not inclusive. Never mind that Dersham was making a plea for the inclusion of sexual minorities in his school. Grabbing Dersham's speech from the podium, his principal crumpled it into a ball, check out the YouTube video if you don't believe me, and told Dersham to read his pre-approved address. Meaningful speech is almost never inclusive, if that means agreeing with everyone else. And if it does, it's probably not very meaningful. That's why so many graduation addresses are littered with cliches that don't teach us much of anything. And too many schools want to keep it that way. In Pennsylvania, a school pulled the plug on a 2017 graduation speaker when he criticized the school officials for, you can't make this up, ignoring student voices and ideas. Watch that video too. The mic went quiet, but the student continued to talk until a principal ushered him off the stage. His classmates gave him a standing ovation, and above the din, you can hear someone shouting, "Let him speak!" That's also what the Supreme Court said last week when it ruled that another Pennsylvania teenager couldn't be suspended from her cheerleading team for a profanity-laden Snapchat post denouncing the team and her school. Context matters, of course, if she had used the same off-color words in class or in a graduation speech, the school would have been within its rights to cut her off. But Bryce Dershowne and other commencement speakers haven't been censored for being vulgar. Instead, their real sin was being controversial. They were saying something significant about issues that matter to them, and their school didn't want that. To its credit, Paxton Smith's high school let her finish her address without silencing her microphone. But the school board president, Karen Clardy, said Smith's actions were unexpected and not supported by her school district, which would try to prevent something like this from happening again. That's why the rest of us need to make sure that it does, by raising our own voices on behalf of students' free speech. And it shouldn't matter if we agree with the speech or not. I share Paxton Smith's opinion on abortion rights, so it's easy for me to praise her for speaking out about them. It's much harder to allow someone to have their say when you think they're wrong. Let the students speak. Freedom for speech that I like frees up American schools to censor anything they don't like. And that's not freedom at all. You might even call it un-American. Jonathan Zimmerman teaches education and history at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book, co-authored with Signe Wilkinson, is Free Speech and Why You Should Give a Damn. Turning to the opinion page in the USA Today, Sheila C. Baer, Fannie Mae board chairwoman, writes, "Think hard before turning home equity into cash. Prices are soaring, but weigh risks and benefits." National home prices have grown by about 15% over the past year, giving homeowners greater equity and financial security. At the same time, rising prices have helped drive an increase in cash-out refinancing, where homeowners refinance to a lower mortgage interest rate while also taking money out by tapping into their increased home equity. In fact, according to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac data, last year, approximately $185 billion of equity was extracted through cash-out refinances, and the most since 2007, right before the great financial crisis. In many cases, a cash-out refinance makes sense, allowing a family to cover a medical emergency or a longer-term investment such as college tuition or a home renovation. But cash-out refinances can also carry risks that every homeowner and every lender should consider, especially during times of rapid home price increases, such as now. Risks of quick cash. The first risk is simple. Home prices go up and they go down. We've seen several cycles over the past few decades where home prices in many major markets drop significantly. If a home's value drops below the loan's value, the borrower's equity evaporates. The second risk is using a home's equity for quick cash instead of a cushion or a tool for building wealth. In a worst-case scenario, a homeowner might decide to use the family home as an ATM machine, taking out large amounts of money and making a risky assumption that housing prices will keep going up indefinitely. Between 2005 and 2007, in the run-up to the great financial crisis, millions of borrowers extracted equity from their homes, fueled by skyrocketing prices, lax lending standards, and speculative investors. Irresponsible lenders profited, but borrowers had to live with the fallout. Caution, but not alarm. The result was a tragic spiral of underwater mortgages, foreclosures, and bankruptcies for families, and instability and weakness for the broader economy that took years to recover from. The financial health of some borrowers caught in that economic spiral has never recovered. Today, thanks to more responsible lending standards, many of the factors that led to the 2008 crisis are not present. The financial industry has learned many lessons from that time. Fannie Mae, for example, now requires that cash-out refinance loans be no greater than 80% of the home's value. We also require at least 6 months of verified reserves for homeowners whose monthly debt payments are 45% or more of their monthly incomes. These standards help protect consumers and the housing finance system against risks such as falling home prices or economic shocks. In fact, the overall picture of today's cash-out refinance market is one calling for caution, but not alarm. According to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, only 36% of 2020 refinances resulted in a new mortgage balance that was at least 5% greater than the previous balance. Compare this with 78% of refinances from 2005 to 2008. As home prices continue to rise, however, the temptation to push the envelope will likely grow for both lenders and homeowners. Homeowners considering a cash-out refinance need to keep a few facts in mind. One, a mortgage is secured by your home. Unlike credit cards and many other loans, missing the monthly payment on your cash-out refinance loan could cost you your home. Two, refinancing is not free. Typically, closing costs run from 2 to 5% of the loan amount, skimming off some of the homeowner's equity. In addition, while Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac won't back a cash-out refinance loan with less than 20% equity, if a homeowner or lender choose to go that route, the homeowner should expect an annual mortgage insurance premium of 0.4% to 2.5% of the loan balance. Three, home prices can fall. No one knows for certain where housing prices are headed. Anyone who says otherwise might not have your best interests at heart. Fannie Mae economists believe that home prices will continue to grow through the end of 2022, but that's just our projection. And if you enter into a cash out refinancing, assuming it's a certainty, you could be putting your home at risk. Four, houses require upkeep. Roofs need to be repaired, aging appliances need to be replaced, maintenance costs can be expensive. By preserving home equity, families have a resource they can tap to make needed investments in their homes to maintain and enhance their properties. And finally, number five, there are other refinance options. A non-cash-out refinancing that lowers your interest rate can lower your monthly house payment, taking pressure off your budget. A refinancing that shortens your term can help you build equity faster. These facts underscore one overriding truth. Home ownership can be one of the most effective ways of building wealth. However, entering into a long-term mortgage and building equity requires care and diligence. But the payoff in the years to come can be tremendous, helping families weather financial shocks and save for things like retirement and even passing wealth on to children or grandchildren. Pulling cash out of a home puts those long-term benefits at risk, so weigh the costs, benefits, and risks carefully. Sheila C. Baer is the chairwoman of Fannie Mae's board of directors and former chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Chris Hanna, a Toronto-based editor and writer, writes, "No, you do not get straight pride. We can't legislate our way out of hatred. If anyone even mentions straight pride in my vicinity, I will scream. And I don't mean get into a shouting match or yell about LGBTQ plus rights, hard fought, fleeting, at risk. I mean a loud, guttural, sustained scream. It seems anytime a minority group desperately, though deftly, miraculously, managed to make enough noise to have their concerns heard, the majority quickly see it as a threat to their very comfortable status quo. Black lives matter must mean that white ones don't. Women's empowerment must weaken men. And so every June, pride revelers must dodge blaring refrains of, what do they want now? And what if we had a straight pride on top of the usual social, legal, professional, and personal hurdles they already face year round? 22% of LGBTQ plus people in the United States live in poverty, compared with 16% of straight cisgender people, according to a 2019 report from UCLA School of Law's Williams Institute, a research institute on sexual orientation and gender identity law and public policy. According to another survey by the Williams Institute, more than two-thirds of teens surveyed experience family rejection after coming out, and one in four are forced to leave their homes. A survey from a United Kingdom advocacy group found that LGBTQ plus youth are twice as likely to contemplate suicide and that Black LGBTQ plus youth are three times as likely. Hate crime epidemic. In Canada, between 25% and 40% of youth experiencing homelessness identify as LGBTQ+, according to the 519, a City of Toronto agency. In the United States, LGBTQ plus youth are 120% more likely to experience homelessness than non-LGBTQ youth, according to Chaplain Hall at the University of Chicago. I first broached the ludicrous concept of straight pride in USA Today in 2018, and have only grown angrier that so little has changed. In fact, things have worsened considerably, and particularly for transgender people. Hate crimes motivated by hate of gender identity, especially against trans people, rose 20% from 2018 to 2019, almost definitely an underestimate, as not all crimes are reported and not all reported crimes are properly identified. The American Medical Association in 2019 called this an epidemic, a term then candidate Joe Biden would repeat in October of 2020, just before the election. Dehumanizing government actions and rhetoric, as well as a failure to address risk factors like domestic and intimate partner violence, underemployment and unemployment and poverty, housing insecurity and health disparities put this community at risk, Biden said in the statement at the time. The Human Rights Campaign has identified more than 110 bills targeting transgender people introduced in states in our current legislative session alone, the most by far of any year since the LGBTQ plus advocacy group started tracking them. Some have been defeated, but even so, the damage is done and long-lasting. An ACLU lawyer and trans rights activist, Chase Stranglio, recently told Elle magazine, "The conversations themselves are causing serious harm to trans youth who are watching their government debate their existence in deeply disturbing ways." Non-allies straight people. Only in 2020 were sexual orientation and gender identity finally protected in America's workplace after a landmark Supreme Court case extended the interpretation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act to also include transgender Americans. Before this, laws differed by state and whether the employer was public or private. This was thanks in no part to corporations, by the way, who are so quick to plaster logos and facades with rainbows, but so quiet when it comes to actually advocating for the same LGBTQ plus people whose dollars they so covet. Some even have the audacity to donate millions to anti-gay politicians, according to a Forbes contributor. The mission of Pride has always been political, to shed light on issues affecting our communities, to organize and even to celebrate each other. This must continue. After COVID-19 forced the shuttering of so many safe gathering spaces for us, the community needs pride and to breathe a sigh of relief this year. In 2021, it is still incredibly brave to come out knowing what waits on the other side. Maybe one day that can change and we won't feel like our entire existence and safety hinge on the whims of mostly legislatures. Even so, we can't legislate our way out of hatred, out of people's disdain for those who don't conform. So no, you don't get straight pride, straight apathy, maybe, straight disillusionment, maybe even be more apt. But to claim that non-ally straight people are deserving of their own celebration when they are the cause of the pain of so many they willingly hurt, well, that is straight up lunacy. Chris Hanna is an editor and writer based in Toronto. And one final news article from the USA Today, John Fritz writes, "Justices won't hear trans bathroom case. Ruling that found school's policy to be discriminatory will stand." The Supreme Court on Monday declined to wade into a dispute over whether schools may bar transgender students from using a bathroom that reflects their gender identity, permitting a lower court ruling against those prohibitions to stand. At issue in the case was whether federal anti-discrimination law applied to LGBTQ students. Gloucester County School Board in Virginia argued its policy of requiring transgender students to use unisex bathrooms was permitted under a 50-year-old law that prohibits discrimination at schools that receive federal funding. By not taking the case, the Supreme Court, without comment, let stand a ruling by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit that found the school's policy discriminated against Gavin Grimm, a transgender man who was denied access to the boys' bathroom years ago when he was a high school student. I'm glad that my years-long fight to have my school see me for who I am is over, Grimm said in a statement released by the American Civil Liberties Union, which represented him in the case. Trans youth deserve to use the bathroom in peace without being humiliated and stigmatized by their own school board and elected officials. Neither the school district nor its attorneys responded to a request for comment. Associate Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito said they would have taken the case, though they did not elaborate on their position. The Supreme Court did not rule on the underlying legal questions, and experts say more cases involving transgender rights will arrive at the highest court as conservative states pass a bevy of laws restricting those rights. The case returned to the court at a time when Biden administration is seeking to expand legal protections for transgender students. In one of his first executive orders, President Joe Biden said the federal government would seek to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case once more before, in 2016, based on guidance from the Obama administration that nudged schools to adopt policies favoring transgender students. But the court dropped the case months later, wiping out a lower court ruling for Grimm when the Trump administration withdrew the guidance. Biden administration reinstated the Obama-era guidance earlier this month. Grimm's case, meanwhile, continues to wind its way back through the federal courts, even as he graduated from high school and moved to California for college. In the meantime, the Supreme Court held last year that prohibitions on workplace discrimination on the basis of sex also extended protections to LGBTQ Americans. The legal fight between LGBTQ advocates and their opponents has since shifted to whether other laws that bar sex discrimination similarly protect people in other settings based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. The debate featured prominently in Grimm's case. Grimm was a rising sophomore when he changed his first name to Gavin and began using male pronouns. Officials at Gloucester High School were supportive, but blowback from parents prompted the school board to bar Grimm from the boys' bathroom, directing him instead to unisex bathrooms, three of which were built in response to the controversy. Grimm said the mandate made him feel stigmatized and isolated. The unisex bathrooms were unavailable when he attended football games and after-school activities. Grimm would often hold it, leading to urinary tract infections. He sued in 2015, claiming the board's policy violated the Title IX and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Though the ACLU and LGBTQ advocates applauded the court's decision as a victory, the legal ramification was less clear. Appeals courts in Chicago and Atlanta, as well as the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia, have held that schools violate federal law when they prohibit transgender boys from using the same restroom as cisgender boys. Legal questions remain unsettled at the national level. The Supreme Court's decision to not hear the Grimm case is a victory for trans students, and it might influence how some lower courts view similar cases, said Jamie Taylor, political science professor at the University of Toledo and an expert on LGBTQ policies. However, this does not set national precedent. That lack of clarity comes amid an onslaught of state laws attempting to limit transgender rights. Those include a Tennessee law requiring transgender students to compete in school sports according to their sex assigned at birth. Arkansas this year became the first state to ban gender-affirming treatment for transgender minors. That's it for our second hour of the Register on Iris. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Lisa Horsch. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.